He had offered to pick up Darlene at the school campus after his training and take her to dinner. She was texting that she had to finish a project and would catch a ride to meet him at a restaurant she liked. "See you at 7? "Okay," he typed back. The delay gave him a bit of extra time to follow up on the favor for the rookie. No matter how good the class, being cooped up in a room with no windows for hours made him restless. He was glad to be free. He took the bypass to U.S. 85 and got off at the exit for the Pueblo. He didn't see the governor's office, so he stopped at the community center and spoke to the receptionist after showing her his credentials.
"Caitlin Vigil?"
The receptionist gave him a puzzled look.
"She's never been one to get in trouble."
"She's not in trouble. Someone in my office back in Shiprock is friendly with an elderly lady who knows Caitlin. He asked me to stop by to say hello while I'm in Santa Fe taking a class." Despite a universe of differences, the Pueblo people and the Navajo share an attitude of respect for their elders.
"I'll tell you where she lives. Tell her hello from Vanjie, too."
The young woman's grin showed her braces. The directions eventually led him to a sprawling house under a large cottonwood tree. None of the homes had numbers, and none of the streets had street signs. Not much different from the nation, except that Tusuki Pueblo included about 500 members, and the Navajo Nation spread over 3 states, with a population 500 times larger. A blue Volvo station wagon from the 70s with a yellow daisy fastened to the antenna with duct tape was parked outside. He knocked on the front door, but there was no answer. He tried again, listening for someone stirring, and looked around to see if any curious neighbors had spotted him. The place seemed deserted except for some ravens sitting in the dormant trees. Even the birds looked cold. He went back to his truck, found some paper, and wrote a note asking Caitlin to call him on his cell phone. He added a line he thought might get her attention, and slipped the sheet and his business card into a crack in the frame. As he was leaving, he heard a door open toward the rear of the house, and an old woman called out in a language he didn't understand. He turned toward her and she studied his face.
"I thought you were curly. I thought that Navajo had finally gotten a real job. But you're too big. He's a pipsqueak."
She spoke in English. "I'm not curly," she said, "but I'd like to talk to him, or to his wife. Is this where they live?" The woman said nothing. "They aren't in trouble. No, ma'am, not at all. A friendly visit."
"Then you got the right house."
"I left a note there." He indicated the front door with a twist of his head. "If you see them, could you tell them I'd like to talk to them for just a minute or two?"
"I can't."
She waited.
"I don't know your name. What's the matter with you?"
He introduced himself. Because she wasn't Navajo, he didn't name his clans. Because she was an elder and a Pueblo Indian person, he knew she would care more about where he came from than what he did. But after talking about his family, he added that he had been in training as a Hatossi and had mentioned his rank as a sergeant with the Navajo police. He told her he lived in Shiprock and a little about Bernie.
"I am Mrs. Vigil. If you want to talk to my daughter, you can call her in Santa Fe. She works at the land office."
"What about her husband?"
"She never should have married him."
And before Chi could ask if she'd seen the man, Mrs. Vigil disappeared behind a closed door. Knowing the offices at the state capitol had closed at 5 p.m., Chi decided to call later and drove to the restaurant Darlene had suggested. The pantry, across the street and down a few blocks from the Indian hospital, looked as welcoming, unpretentious, and well-stocked as its name. He parked in the paved lot behind the building, and as he headed toward the entrance, he noticed the bus stop bench down the street. So Darlene had figured out how to take the Santa Fe buses. She hadn't had much practice doing that in Todlina or Shiprock, because there were no public buses except for the big yellow school buses and the Navajo transportation line that took people to Window Rock if they didn't mind leaving around 5 a.m. Back home, everyone he knew drove, caught a ride, or walked. It was another 15 minutes before the bus pulled up. Darlene wasn't on it. He dialed her number. When she answered, he heard the strain in her voice.
I was about to call you. I missed the bus, but I guess you know that. I thought CS would give me a ride, but well, that didn't work.
She'd left her car at Mama's house because information the school sent highly recommended that students in Darlene's program not bring vehicles to campus. What if I come pick you up?
Are you driving a police car?
No, my truck, but I'm still in uniform.
A pause, and then, I'll wait for you by the main entrance. Let me know when you get close.
Chi had never been to the Institute of American Indian Arts campus before, but he found it easily. The location, away from town and south of a development of new earth-colored homes, surprised him. He liked the modern look of the campus, and especially the mountain views that formed its backdrop. As he pulled up, Darlene wobbled her way toward the passenger door, and he wondered if she had been drinking again. He reached over to open it for her. Why don't you take off your sunglasses? You don't need them now.
Right.
She closed the door and then put her sunglasses on her lap. Even in the dim light inside the vehicle, he noticed the tears. He handed her a napkin from the side panel pocket. You want to talk about it? When something upset Bernie, his dear wife didn't want to talk about whatever had happened. Or at least she didn't want to talk about it right then and to him. Hours later, she'd matter-of-factly tell him someone she knew had been diagnosed with a terrible disease, or lost her job, or that she had rearrested a suspect she thought had cleaned up his act. The only variation in the way Bernie handled bad news came if the problem was something she thought he could help with. In that case, he'd watch her put emotions aside, activate her logical brain, and enlist him to work with her to resolve the issue. By then, she had usually conjured up an assortment of possible solutions, and she'd listened to his opinion on each one. He loved her take-charge attitude. But sometimes he wished she could be a little more vulnerable, more open to sharing. Her sister was as different from Bernie as he could imagine. Darlene, always a talker, went into overdrive when she was angry or sad or discouraged. Most Navajo people he knew believed that words should be used sparingly and selected them with care to say only what was meant in the clearest way possible. Despite Mama's best teaching, Darlene subscribed to the more is better approach. She steadied himself for an evening of serious listening.
Let's go for a ride.
Darlene reached for her seatbelt, revealing a large blue bruise on her arm. Sure. Do you want something to eat?
I don't know.
He pulled away from the school entrance onto a quiet paved street. The Institute of American Indian Arts, or IAIA, wasn't convenient to anything, and that, in his opinion, added to its appeal when it came to Darlene. Kids without cars had to settle for on-campus distractions, minimizing the chance for chaos.
You remember CS?
She squeaked out the name.
He told me to take this program, even helped me with the paperwork, but now he totally ignores me like I'm a big inconvenience. When I suggest that we do something, he's too busy. And when his friends are around, he blows me off, like he's embarrassed. I don't see him hardly at all because he's working all the time, like tonight. I asked him if he wanted to come with me to dinner, but no, no, no. He always says he's working.
She underlined says with the tone of her voice. Complaining seemed to invigorate Darlene. She recited a litany of complaints against her boyfriend as Chi drove past houses in various shades of brown, large but clustered together despite all the open land here. He knew Darlene didn't expect him to interrupt her monologue.
And when I try to tell him how I feel, he says I should focus on the program, work on my drawings, not think about him so much. And now when I asked him for a ride because I missed the bus, he told me he couldn't do it because of the stupid videos and because his friend was coming to the studio. I'd like to know who this friend is.
Chi drove along, minding the speed limit, passing a woman walking a dog on a leash, kids riding bikes. He found a turnout with a view of the mountains to the northwest, parked and turned off the engine, breathing in the spectacular panorama of a spectacular evening. The fading glow of sunset danced against the flanks of the Jemez Range, and he could see the flicker of the faraway lights of Los Alamos, a city created to build the atomic bomb. Darlene stopped talking and looked out the window. After a while, Chi broke the silence. "I don't know much about C.S. Where is he from?" Darlene rattled off his mother's Born-II clan, and his father's Born-IV clan, and those of his grandparents on both sides.
"We're not related. He's not even related to you, Cheeseburger. Not that I'm thinking of marrying the big jerk."
"I ran into him today at a restaurant, but he pretended not to recognize me, and I didn't immediately remember where I had seen him before." He told her about the encounter. "Do you know a man named Clyde Herbert?" She glanced up at him.
"What does he look like?"
She described him.
"I think I sort of met him, but C.S. didn't tell me who he was. C.S. and I drove over to his house. The guy was, like, in the driveway waiting for us, and he walked up to the car and stared at me like he was surprised I was there or something. Then he told C.S. he couldn't do it until tomorrow, whatever that meant. Does he have a tattoo on his neck?"
"That's him. He was with C.S. at lunch. The guy has a real attitude." She shrugged.
"All I know is that when we drove away from Herbert's place, C.S. said he was working with that guy. And then C.S. is like, 'Oh, I don't want to tell you because it's not firmed up yet.'"
She heard the anger in her voice. He gathered his thoughts. "I've arrested Herbert a couple times for drugs and aggravated battery. He went to prison, and I thought he was still there."
"Battery? Was he stealing batteries? What's up with that?"
"No, battery is hitting somebody. I think you..." He stopped. Darlene absolutely resented anyone telling her what to do. "I mentioned Herbert because he's a convicted felon. I want to make sure you're safe, especially if C.S. is hanging with him. Are they friends?"
"I don't know."
She could tell by the tone of her voice she was annoyed, but was it with him or C.S.? They reached a thoroughfare that took them past the Santa Fe Community College and eventually to a busier street. Darlene told him to turn right and directed him to Harry's Roadhouse a few minutes east of town. They ordered pizza, roasted chicken with green chili, and sat at a window table waiting for it. She had a coffee, and Darlene ordered water and a side salad. In the years she had known Bernie, beginning when she was a rookie cop and he was her boss, she had never ordered a salad at a restaurant. Now that they were married, she never made one at home, although she politely had a bite or two of the ones he created if he included iceberg lettuce, and she could eat around the other vegetables. She liked green chili with pinto beans and chicken, but would never have considered either of them on a pizza. Only pepperoni for her. He missed her already. Darlene ignored him, preoccupied with eating the salad, checking her phone, and texting. He enjoyed the smell of baking pizza and the diner-like feel of the place. The decor reminded him of Blue Moon, one of his favorite stops in Farmington, except that Blue Moon had no pizza, and Harry's had no milkshakes. When the pizza arrived, Darlene looked up.
"You know, even though C.S. is acting like a big fool, I'm glad I came to the school here. The program is awesome. The drawing teacher comes from, you know, one of those tribes up in Canada where they live by the ocean. He has us walking around drawing stuff, quick sketches. He does some, too, and then we all talk about the drawings. But he only lets us say what we like about the other people's work. In the first class, he asked us to do this really cool assignment."
Darlene smiled for the first time that evening and talked on. If it hadn't been for the uneasy feeling he had about her boyfriend associating with a thug, Chi would have let Darlene's stream of consciousness roam free. Instead, he corralled it with a question when she paused for breath. "This pizza is good. Do you and C.S. come here?"
"Yeah, we have the veggie because he doesn't eat chicken or sausage or anything."
"Does he live with relatives here?" Darlene picked up the pizza slice and took a bite.
He's using his friend's apartment.
What's it like? A safer question, she figured, then. Have you been there?
It's little.
She slipped off her sweater, revealing the discoloration on her arm beneath the sleeve of her t-shirt.
That's quite a bruise. What happened?
An accident.
She tugged her sleeve down.
Do you remember that cool movie we made of the grandmother out by Coal Mine Canyon who wanted to talk to the president, you know, the Navajo president, and bring her sheep along?
I know you guys went out there to chat with her about the situation. I haven't seen the video.
He says he's still working on it.
Her skepticism rang in the words.
You know, just like you don't believe him, I don't believe that bruise was an accident.
She took a sip of water.
Are you going to eat that last piece?
He moved the pan away from her.
You can have it if you tell me what happened to your arm.
It's nothing. Forget about it.
Remember I said the reason Herbert went to prison is that he hit someone. It was a woman he lived with. He broke her ribs. It bothered me to see C.S. with him, and it bothers me that C.S. pretended we'd never met.
Maybe he didn't recognize you. He wouldn't have expected to see you in Santa Fe.
Herbert knew who I was, and I hadn't seen him since his trial.
Darlene stopped eating.
C.S. isn't mean like that. No way.
Then why won't you tell me what happened?
The words hung between them as the server cleared the plates and offered dessert, which they declined. Chi went to the cashier and paid the bill. When he returned, Darlene stood and slipped on her jacket.
Don't tell Bernie about Herbert and C.S., please. She's got enough on her mind helping Mama while I'm taking this class.
I won't say anything for now, but you need to tell me the truth about that bruise.
It was an accident, okay?
Tears pooled in her eyes.
Leave me alone. You don't have to take me back to campus. There's a bus stop right at the corner.
I don't mind.
I'm a big girl, she snapped out the words. I really can take care of myself.
When he couldn't talk her out of it, Chi left Darlene there and drove back to his motel. He changed out of his uniform into soft jeans and a plaid shirt. Then he phoned Lieutenant Leaphorn. When he thought he'd have to call back, Louisa Bourbonnette, Leaphorn's housemaid, answered.
Sergeant Chi, how nice to hear from you.
Good evening. You seem a little hoarse.
It's nothing.
They chatted for a moment, and then she said,
I bet you want to talk to Joe. I'll give him the phone.
Yeah, there.
Leaphorn's voice sounded clear and strong.
Chi, how are you tonight?
He spoke in Navajo, the language that came to him more easily than English.
I'm fine, sir. How are you?
Leaphorn said he was feeling fine, and added that he had accepted a set of new assignments and was enjoying the work. Chi never much enjoyed talking on the phone, unless it was to Bernie, and even in person, face to face, he felt awkward making small talk. This was doubly true in conversations with the lieutenant, the man who had been both his mentor and his biggest critic.
Captain Largo sent me to Santa Fe for some training, so that's where I am.
He described the classes and some of the old-timers Leaphorn might know. All that took about a minute. Then she steeled himself and got to the point.
I could use some help, sir. Do you remember Herbert Clyde from Fort Defiance?
No.
She paused. Leaphorn, at least before a crazy woman shot him in the head, never forgot a name or a face.
He's a stocky guy, sir. He used to rodeo until he got into meth. Mean. He had a wife in Shiprock. I arrested him a few times, once in connection with that drug trafficking case we were helping the feds with. The rest was domestic violence.
I don't know any Herbert Clyde, but if you're talking about Clyde Herbert... Of course I remember him. He beat his wife with his Smirnoff bottle, broke her bones. Why do you ask?
Chi, who prided himself on his own excellent memory, felt his face warm with embarrassment. He plodded on.
I just saw him in Santa Fe. This dude's associating with Bernie's sister's new boyfriend. I thought you might be able to help me fill in the blanks. He heard Leaphorn sigh.
This is the girl with the blue hair who got arrested. Darlene.
Yes, sir. But the blue is gone, and she has green streaks now. She's up here in Santa Fe, too, for a week in a special art program. I'm concerned that this guy she's hanging with might be trouble. She said the boyfriend and Herbert are working on a project together, but she didn't know what the project was. She paused, but when Leaphorn didn't say anything, he continued. I can't check on the boyfriend while I'm here in Santa Fe, but I'm wondering if he's been in some trouble, too. I haven't mentioned any of this to Bernie. I didn't want to bother her with it, at least not until I know what's going on. Leaphorn might not want to do him a favor, but she knew the old lieutenant was fond of Bernie.
What's this boyfriend's name?
She told him and gave him C.S.'s approximate age and physical description.
Oh, I'll check on Clyde Herbert, too, and I'll email you what I find out. And she?
Yes, sir.
It's a very bad idea to try to keep a secret from your wife. It never works out well, even if your intentions are good.
Before Chi figured out how to respond, Leaphorn had hung up.
5. Jim Chi had just turned on the TV when his phone beeped with a text. Darlene had left her sunglasses in his truck. Could he drop them off for her at school on his way to his own class? She told him what dorm she was in and said he could leave them for her at the desk. No, he thought. He had to be at the police academy early, and her campus wasn't on the way to anywhere. He'd drive them out to her tonight. He felt uneasy, and the drive might help him relax. Besides, he wanted to check on her after seeing that bruise. He drove down Cerrillos Road to Rodeo Road, then south on Richards Avenue, once again past the community college and into the foothills until he reached Darlene's school. It pleased him to see a security guard at the campus gate. He explained his mission, and she found Darlene's name in the student directory, told him how to get to the dorm, and waved him through. At the front desk, he learned that Darlene had signed out for a movie required for class. He left her sunglasses with the attendant, a young woman in her early 30s with black-framed glasses who was engrossed in reading something on her laptop. One more question. Where is the studio for videos?
That's the next building over. If you want to talk to somebody about using the lab, you should come back tomorrow. I don't think anyone's there now except maybe some students.
He walked to the building anyway, in the hope that maybe he'd run into C.S. and could have a little chat with him about his felon friend. The building looked dark and empty, and there was only one vehicle outside, an old minivan idling at the loading dock. He heard roughness from the engine. If his truck sounded that bad, he would be worried. A gray-haired woman stood outside the van by the side door, fumbling with the latch.
"Ma'am, do you need some help?"
He felt for the small flashlight in his pocket. She looked up and stepped away from him.
"You scared me, sneaking up like that. Who are you?"
She was a small woman with a loud authoritarian voice. Probably a teacher, Chi guessed. He didn't move any closer.
"It looks like you could use a hand there."
She inched toward the van and stared at him.
"Who are you, and what are you doing here?"
The fear in her voice surprised him.
"I'm Jim Chi, Navajo Police, the brother-in-law of one of the bridge program students."
He switched the flashlight to his left hand, pulled out his ID, and shone the light on it as he held it toward her.
"Okay, Sergeant Jim. I'm Beverly Lamasi, Hopi in Laguna Pueblo. I teach here. Bring over that flashlight and help me slide this door closed."
He walked to the minivan, noticing that even though her hair was gray, she was not elderly, perhaps in her 40s. He discovered that the side door needed to be fully reopened and closed again with a firm push.
"Now shine that light on the building's back door here so I can get my key in. I forgot my laptop inside."
"Do you work in this building?"
I'm glad you're suspicious. She reached inside her jacket and pulled out a strap with her college ID card. He aimed his light toward it. Same woman. She let the card dangle on the cord. Like it says, I'm the assistant director of Media Arts, and this is the Media Arts building. Who's your student? She told her. Mrs. Lamassi said, shine your light down a little. This lock is tricky. He did as directed. I work with the bridge program. I can't place Darlene. She has green in her hair. A Navajo who likes to draw. Oh, right. Mrs. Lamassi fiddled with the lock. She sketched a picture of me while I was teaching. Not bad.
Do you know a guy named Clayton Cicotti? He goes by C.S.
C.S.? I see him in the studio and around campus. He's working on a video project so he can finally graduate. Why do you ask?
Darlene is hanging out with him. I'm curious.
She finally got the door to open and flicked on the switch inside the entrance. C.S., huh? Tell Darlene she needs to... Oh, never mind. Kids don't want advice from anybody except their friends.
She turned away from him. Do you know if C.S. is here tonight?
He was here, and I'm sure he'll be back. He's doing a lot of editing.
She said, would you like me to wait and walk back to the van?
Mrs. Lamassi laughed. Nope, but thanks for the offer. Tell Darlene she needs to turn in her homework.
He returned to his truck for the drive back to the motel. Somewhere in the distance he heard a coyote and a few dogs barking in response. Mostly, what she listened to was the welcome silence he had been missing. Santa Fe's cacophony of traffic noise, car radios, and the occasional siren made him a little edgy. Combined with Darlene's stonewalling when it came to her bruise, and the day's steady bombardment of strangers, including the prickly Mrs. Lamassi, the noise left him out of sorts and off balance. He parked in the motel lot, noticing the city noise again. He wondered if Darlene appreciated the quiet of the campus. Bernie had given him a book last week, and he packed it in his suitcase. It was by a fellow shiprock person, Lucy Tapahunso, the Navajo Nation's first poet laureate. He thought it an interesting gift. He liked to read, but he stayed with nonfiction, especially history. He'd brought Lucy's book with him to make Bernie happy, but it was whittling away his prejudice against poetry. He'd read a little more after he called her. He sat in the chair next to the bed and dialed. When Bernie's phone and the landline both went straight to voicemail, she called her mother's house. In the old days, sons-in-law and mothers-in-law kept their distance. Times had changed, and it didn't make sense to pretend Bernie's mama wasn't part of their lives. He treated the elderly woman with respect and reserve. He listened to six rings, and then remembered that Mama and Mrs. Big Man, her weaving student, were planning to go to the Crown Point rug auction. Mama was probably off somewhere getting ready. When Bernie told him about the trip, he'd heard something unusual in her voice. Regret? His wife had started a rug but hadn't made much progress. She had talked to Mama about teaching her again, but Mama said she should practice first to get her hands and her brain working to remember what she knew already. He picked up his book again but couldn't focus on it, his mind wandering back to the scene at Tasuki Pueblo. From Caitlin's mother's reaction to seeing him, he doubted that son-in-law George was at the old house. He imagined Mrs. Vigil made the man's life miserable. And back in Navajo land, it sounded like Mrs. Curley took every opportunity she could find to irritate Caitlin, her daughter-in-law. Both elderly ladies wasting precious energy on something that was not their business. It made him appreciate Bernie's mama, and yes, even Darlene. Chi's class notes were in his truck. It wouldn't hurt to look them over before the next day's session, and a little fresh air would calm his spirit. He took the stairs down to the lobby two at a time.
The stairway door opened onto the hallway a few steps from the business center, the euphemism for a room just big enough to hold a desk with a computer, a printer, a chair, and a wastebasket. The hotel arranged the system for guests to conveniently print airline boarding passes, but Chi had figured out how to check his email. The lieutenant had already sent him something, an attachment with a terse note.
"Here's what I have so far. Odd. Still checking."
He opened the file and saw a State of New Mexico death certificate for Clayton Sicote. 6. Bernadette Manuelito had had an interesting day. As Manzanares predicted, the search and rescue effort began to roll into place. The incident commander arrived, and volunteers followed. They set up a communication center in the parking lot with computers, supplies for the search teams, and more. The searchers included retirees and young folks, men and women. Some were ground pounders trained to work in the backcountry. They did the physical searching. Others were support and logistics crew, all volunteers taking time from their regular lives to help a stranger. Bernie gave the incident commander, a sturdy-looking 50-something woman named Beverly Katz, the detailed description Cooper had written. Katz read the note.
"She even included the reflective trim on his jacket, but she doesn't mention any relatives. We could use that information. I know this isn't your problem, officer, but since you've already been in contact with..."
Katz looked at the note again.
"With Rose Cooper, I'd appreciate it if you could give me a name or two, just in case."
"I told Mrs. Cooper I'd call her when the search started, so I can ask about that."
"I'm hopeful that it won't take long to find him."
Kat zipped her jacket against the afternoon breeze.
"Can you show me where the base camp was before you leave?"
She talked as Bernie led the way.
"It sounds like Cruz is experienced in the out-of-doors and knows this particular landscape. If he is injured badly enough that he can't get back here, he'll stay put. He won't panic. He knows that the people he was with would call for help."
Katz looked at the sky.
"The weather seems to be cooperating for now, but I saw that a big storm is on the way."
The sandy path to the group gathering place on the mesa was easier than the hike with Mayfair. Like Mayfair, Katz moved quickly and stayed on Bernie's heels. Bernie tossed out a question.
"You mentioned one scenario where Cruz waits by a trail to be found, but what else could happen?"
"Well, we keep in mind the possibility that he suffered an injury that could create some confusion. Lots of trails cross through the lava or lead from here into the sandstone cliffs. Even without an injury, anyone can get disoriented. Or maybe Mr. Cruz met someone who was hurt and is helping that person. This area is popular with hikers."
"I hadn't thought of that. The Wings and Roots van was the only vehicle in the lot when I got here."
"Sometimes hikers have friends drop them off and pick them up,"
Kat said.
"And there are several other trailheads. We haven't had any other missing person reports, but it's always a possibility, especially when people hike alone and forget to tell anyone where they're headed."
The path widened, and Katz moved beside her and glanced across the mesa top and out to the highway and the lava beyond.
"As a police officer, you're probably aware of this already, but sometimes people go off by themselves to have some space to think, especially if they're feeling overwhelmed by life. Was that true of this man?"
"I asked. His co-worker mentioned that he was about to get a promotion, and also was the chief fundraiser for the organization. That can't be an easy job for any nonprofit. The director denies that he would ever consider suicide. Neither of them used the word depressed when speaking of him." Katz nodded.
"When we talk to the family of the missing person, we always ask them about state of mind and if they have any information that might be helpful for the search. Anything else I should know?"
"Rose Cooper left Cruz's sleeping bag here, in case you need a scent for dogs."
"Good."
When they got to the group assembly area, Kat showed Bernie the map the searchers worked with and how each area the teams had checked would be marked off as the search continued. The highest probability for finding a lost hiker like Cruz, she said, lay in about a 4-mile radius of the last spot where he was seen. That was where the search focused. Finally, Bernie told Katz about the cave with the old bones, and using the map, gave her a rough idea of the location. The search commander thanked her.
"I'll ensure that's undisturbed. We want to find a living man, not the ancient dead."
Bernie made her way off the mesa, walking more slowly, enjoying the view. Even though she had never met Cruz, she felt like she would recognize him if she saw him hiking toward her. She agreed with Katz's assessment that he could be injured and hoped the search would find him alive. If not, she hoped that at least his body would be recovered so his family would have some peace. The afternoon had grown cooler, and a small herd of clouds gathered to the west. The year would be over in a few more weeks. What changes and possibilities would the new year hold? Bernie had parked her unit at the edge of the parking lot, facing the highway. But first things first. As she hiked to the outhouse, she nearly stepped on a cell phone on the ground. She picked it up. From the glittery pink case, it looked like something that might have belonged to one of the teenage girls. The screen was cracked, but still usable. She pushed the on button. No power. She asked the members of the search crew about it, and none of them had lost a phone. They didn't look the type for glitter, but you never know. Bernie left her card at search headquarters in case anyone asked about the phone, and slipped the device into her backpack. Before she left, she checked the time. The program's van and the campers should be in Grant's. She called, and Cooper answered.
"Bernie, did Dom make it back?"
"No. The search crew arrived, and they're getting started."
"I'm waiting for the last few parents to arrive. I was hoping to give the girls some good news."
From the sound of her voice, Cooper could use some good news herself. "How was the drive? I was surprised you had to stop in Grants. Isn't the program based in Shiprock?"
"It is, but this was an excursion for teens in Cibola County, with a few Shiprock girls added to give us a full group."
She heard Cooper's long exhalation.
"The kids were quieter than usual, worried about Mr. Cruz. Annie sat by herself and didn't say a word, a big change from her complaining the whole way. She got really sick, and I had to call an ambulance for her. It was here when we arrived."
"That sounds serious. What was wrong with her?"
"She was hallucinating. That girl, I think she might have had some drugs stashed somewhere. Mayfair called her mother."
Bernie leaned against her SUV. "The incident commander asked me for a list of Mr. Cruz's relatives to inform about the search. She doesn't want them to see this first on TV or read about it. The state police officer who came out told me Cruz's sister married his cousin. Does she still live out here?"
"Yes, she's in Grants, Marilee Cruz. I have her information at the office because she's on the Wings and Roots Board of Directors. She works as a psychotherapist."
Bernie waited, but Cooper didn't mention any other names. "Anyone else?" Cooper sighed.
"Those of us who work with him are as much family as he has. Cruz isn't married. He never talks much about his relatives, and I never ask. He lives with a roommate. Marilee will know more. I'll text you her information as soon as the kids get picked up."
Bernie heard commotion in the background. Cooper said,
"Anything else? I've got to go."
"Did one of the girls mention losing a pink phone?" Cooper laughed.
"No way. Those girls are tied to their phones. If someone had lost it, you would have heard her wailing all the way to Grant's."
After Cooper hung up, Bernie climbed into her unit and put on her seatbelt. Should she call Mama, or should she talk to Chi first? As she was thinking, Largo came on the radio. He got right to the point.
"Things are slow here, and you don't hear me say that often. Finish whatever you need to do out there. You can check in at the office and handle the paperwork in the morning."
"Thanks, I appreciate it."
"Any news on the lost guy?"
Not yet. They only started searching for him.
He's Navajo, right?
Right.
That means he's tough. He'll be okay. Did you tell them about the cave?
Yes, sir. The incident commander is a veteran with search and rescue, and she's from around here. She understood. They have a whole lot of ground to cover without bothering with that place.
Since the search borders on the reservation, there's a chance those bones could be Navajo. I'll put in a call to the state police in Santa Fe to the overall search and rescue director. I know him. And mention the cultural site issues to be on the safe side.
Largo ended the call. Bernie knew the captain didn't like talking about old bones any more than she did, and the Pueblos felt as strongly about the right of their dead to be left in peace. She shifted her thoughts to something more pleasant. Chi. She smiled as she pictured him. He liked going to Santa Fe for the trainings more than she did, and didn't mind getting up in department meetings afterward to share what he had learned. She was glad she didn't have to head back to the office. She decided to take the long way home, and detoured off the freeway to New Mexico 53, the road that skirted the other edge of the Malpais, and headed toward the Zuni Mountains. Driving calmed her, especially driving beautiful empty roads like this one. It had been a good day, and she was encouraged by the incident commander's optimism about finding Mr. Cruz. She'd give the number for Cruz's sister to the incident commander when she got it. She called Chi from the car and left a message when he didn't answer. Sometimes, she thought, a message from him, a quick reminder that she was loved, was enough. She saw the signs for El Morro, a national monument preserving historic graffiti, signatures of the Spanish and American explorers, soldiers, and settlers who had come this way. The visitors had carved their names into the sandstone face. An abandoned pueblo sat on top of the butte, also open to visitors as part of the monument. Maybe their little store had a book about plants of the area, something that fascinated her. She pulled into the parking lot, noticing one other vehicle, a dusty white Toyota 4Runner with an El Morro National Monument bumper sticker. She walked the trail to the visitor center. The ranger, a bright-eyed, gray-haired man, was alone.
"What brings you out this way, officer? I'm Larry Hoffman."
"Bernadette Manuelito. I was in the Malpais, and I got curious about the plants there. Do you have any books about them?"
"Not exactly. Only some general guides to the botany of the desert in the southwest, on the top shelf over there by the window. Take a look and see what you think. You'd have better luck at the bookstore at the El Malpais Visitor Center, the big place off Highway 117.
The monument phone rang.
"Excuse me."
She heard him answer as she walked toward the bookshelves. The plant books were interesting, but not specific to this section of New Mexico, or to species that thrived on lava. But she spotted something a few shelves down that caught her attention, a compilation of stories about the formation of the southwestern landscape. A large, beautiful volume with color photos. It included a version of the Diné story of the monster slayer and his brother, born of water, killing Ye'itso. Unlike the version Bernie knew, in this variation the monster hid his heart and other vital organs in a cave, and when a lightning bolt from Monster Slayer killed him, the blood flowed from the cave entrance and finally solidified into the lava beds. The book had stories from other tribes and included the science of volcanoes and photos of volcanic eruptions and different types of lava from around the world. Chi had been less than excited when she'd given him a poetry collection for his birthday, even though the poems were by the first Navajo poet laureate. This might be more to his liking, but it was expensive. She put it back on the shelf for now.
"That's a lovely book, isn't it?" Hoffman said. "I was surprised that the tribes around here have such similar stories about the lava."
"I wonder what the Spanish and the Americans who came through here thought about all the lava. Had they seen anything like it before?"
"I haven't had the opportunity to study up on that yet. Ask me next time you're out this way, and you can see what a good student I am."
His attitude reminded Bernie of Leaphorn, the way the lieutenant relished an interesting question. Where were you before El Moro?
The Grand Canyon. I was one of the people who got to answer visitor questions.
Hoffman changed the tone of his voice.
How old is the canyon? Why is it here? Can I bring my dog on the trails? How hot is it at the bottom? Is there an ATM? And my favorite. Where is the restroom?
He chuckled.
I was there 5 years until moving out here. The pace of this place is a lot easier on my bad back. I can keep my pain under better control. Are you working out of Ramah, officer?
Please call me Bernie. I was helping a friend, an officer at Ramah, with a special request and got involved in a search out in the Malpais.
Somebody lost, huh? On Navajo land.
Well, hard to say. Part of the lava flow extends onto the Ramah section of the reservation, but the person who is lost was last seen on the other side of the Malpais.
There are some private ranches there, right?
That's right. It's a mix of jurisdictions, and when you're out that way, you don't see any demarcations. The lava has oases of vegetation, caves, stone tubes, cinder cones, lots of lichens you don't find elsewhere. It's really interesting.
Interesting and complicated, like so much of New Mexico. I thought maybe you were out here looking into the vandalism.
I hadn't heard about that. Here at the visitor center.
No. Several people who've stopped here said they had seen cars that someone had broken into, vehicles parked at the pullouts for the Malpais trails. I guess the sheriff or the state police investigate such things. Is that how it works?
Yes, usually. Those kinds of incidents are hard to solve unless there are security cameras that capture the scene and the folks responsible can be ID'd.
Hoffman nodded. We have cameras in here, but we're fortunate. This monument is relatively small, and people watch out for each other. And the only cars here overnight are in the campground. It seems pretty peaceful, as far as I've seen.
Bernie agreed. What crime there is usually involves family violence and burglaries related to drug or alcohol problems. The car break-ins are something new. He smiled at her.
So, you like that geology book? It's beautiful, isn't it?
I think my husband would enjoy it. Is it available in paperback?
I wish. I could sell one or two of those a day. He took the book off the shelf and inspected it. Tell you what, it's kind of shop-worn. You can have it for $10.
Wow, thanks.
It didn't look shop-worn to her.
I'll owe you a favor. As she was paying for it, she discovered another $20 bill in the coin compartment of her wallet and offered it to Hoffman.
No, a deal's a deal. You can do me that favor sometime.
A young couple came in. Instead of looking at the exhibits, they went right to the ranger. The man said, "We have been thinking about that wonderful jug you showed us." The woman said,
"It means the olla. Is that how you say it? The zuni pot."
They both spoke with accents. Maybe French, Bernie thought. Hoffman seemed uncomfortable.
"Wait a minute, please. I'll be right with you. Why don't you take a look at the movie?"
The couple walked into the other room, where a film about El Moro was playing. Hoffman opened the cash drawer and handed Bernie her change and the book. She put the book in her backpack. "I didn't see any pottery for sale in here." Hoffman hesitated.
"I have a friend who asked me to help dispose of some Indian stuff. That couple is lucky. I'm not doing it anymore after this pot."
"Why not?" He shrugged.
"Let's say my friend and I had a philosophical difference of opinion."
Bernie drove toward the quiet junction for Indian Route 125, marked by the yellow "See the Wolf" sign. The road led to Mountain View and the Ramah Navajo Chapter House, as well as the band's school and jail and to the non-Navajo Candy Kitchen Trading Post and Wild Spirit Wolf Sanctuary. The Rama Navajo Indian Reservation didn't abut the vast Navajo Nation land, but rather overlapped two New Mexico counties, west central Cibola and southern McKinley, and adjoined an edge of the Zuni Indian Reservation to the west. It was separated from the nation by private non-Indian holdings, national forests, state land, and an interstate highway. The folks who lived here spoke Diné with a slightly different accent than their non-Rama relatives. She stopped at the Rama police station to say hello. Officers David Bluestone and Philbert Nakai had staffed the substation for the past few years. She told them about the search for Cruz. A woman named Katz is the incident commander.
Good, she's a smart one, Bluestone said. You sure got a surprise when you agreed to do Cheryl a favor.
Nakai raised his eyebrows.
It seems strange that Cruz would get lost. He's been working out there for years. He'd stop by sometimes to chat, usually had his camera with him. Did the state police, I mean, Manzanares, show up?
Yes, but it seemed to take a while to get things rolling. The Rama officers looked at each other. Bernie figured she had company in her assessment of the man. What's new with you two? She said.
The usual, Nakai smiled. I stopped the guy for crossing the center line, twice, right in front of my unit. A woman was next to him, practically on top of him, and I think there was some hanky-panky going on. He acted embarrassed, so I gave him a warning and told her to keep her seatbelt on.
What were they driving?
A new black Jaguar. One of those big sedans with Oklahoma plates.
That car passed me. It looked like they were speeding, too. Bluestone said,
Based on my experience, I think they had a body in the trunk. Probably her husband or his wife.
Nakai chuckled.
Manuelito, mention that to your new FBI agent. Push her buttons a little. I heard the Bureau sent her because they thought we had a testosterone overload out here.
He paused.
How's Chi doing?
He's in Santa Fe for a training.
Tell him to learn something for us.
Back on 53, Bernie headed toward the little community of Rama at the edge of the Rama Navajo Indian Reservation land, a ranching and farming settlement founded by Mormon families, nestled against the backdrop of the Zuni Mountains. To the west lay Zuni Pueblo, at the heart of which an old village of multi-roomed homes enclosed the open-air dance plazas. The bones she'd encountered, she thought, could well belong to an ancestor of one of these residents. An ancient trail through the rock, perhaps a trade route, linked the Zuni and Acoma Pueblos. On this day, though, Bernie turned north onto New Mexico 602 instead. The highway passed the low-lying buildings that housed the Zuni Eagle Sanctuary, home to birds that could no longer fly free, but still produced feathers needed for ceremonies. Beginning the scenic climb through the sandstone and shale cliff that edged the Zuni Mountains, she passed the little settlement of Vanderwagen and its trading post, with plywood cutouts of the Zuni gods. She was headed for the south side of Gallup, the last town where travelers on I-40 could conveniently get a meal or spend the night before the Arizona border. Bernie loved to drive. It gave her a chance to consider things, and on this stretch of familiar highway, she was considering the case of Domingo Cruz. She thought about Annie lying about her mother being dead, but not about the bones. She thought about the cave, and the open van, and the opportunity to specialize in domestic violence. She stopped at a convenience store in Gallup for gas, using the department credit card. While the tank filled, her phone rang. The ID screen read Big Man, the name of her clan brother's wife and Mama's companion at the auction. Why would the woman be calling? Bernie's heart sank. 7. Hello? Bernie heard Mama's voice. Mama sounded fine, and as usual, she didn't waste time with preliminaries.
Have you talked to your sister?
Not today. I've been busy working out where there's no service. I was surprised to see you calling for Mrs. Big Man's phone. How are you, Mama?
Mama ignored the question.
I think something's wrong. When I called her before we left for the auction, she didn't sound right to me. That school is too far away.
You might have caught her at a bad time.
You talk to her. Maybe you should pick her up and bring her back here.
Bernie knew better than to argue with Mama, especially over the phone. But the maybe gave her hope.
My husband is in Santa Fe, and he told me he would go by to see her, make sure she's all right.
You talk to her.
I will call her and see if I can find out what the trouble is.
Okay, then.
Mama's tone of voice said she'd switch to the next subject.
It's good to be in Crown Point. I'm seeing people I had not talked to in a long time. Some of the ladies are like me, getting too old to weave much, but now their daughters are weaving, helping them. You see all the people here, more than when we used to bring my rugs here. Some of them ask about you and your sister. When I tell them you are a policeman, they say that's a good thing.
Bernie waited for Mama to ask if she had been at the loom, but Mama said,
"You call me at home tomorrow when you've talked to your sister. You tell her if she wants to come back, you will pick her up."
And then she was gone. Bernie went into the convenience store for a Coke, only her second of the day. She looked at the M&Ms and the crispy, salty pork skins, and then selected a bag of jerky and a small package of brownies, Mama's favorite. She'd save them until she saw her mother next. The clerk pushed her money away. She smiled at Bernie.
Did anyone ever find out who stole Mr. Harrison's Jeep?
Not yet. Is he related to you?
My sister's father-in-law. She's glad it hasn't come back.
Bernie remembered the case. The Jeep wasn't worth anything, and the officer who investigated assumed that someone in the family had absconded with it to keep the old man from driving on the wrong side of the road with his lights off. The girl laughed.
Now that Grandfather is riding his horse again and they're both losing weight, we don't care if you guys never find the Jeep.
As Bernie walked back to her car, she caught a flash of motion out of the corner of her eye and stopped. A gray mouse scurried into a pile of dried leaves that had blown up against the building. Except for dogs, Bernie was friendly with most living creatures, but mice spread hantavirus, a disease that, like bubonic plague, arose on Navajo land periodically. Mice outside were part of nature, essential in the diets of hawks and coyotes. Mice inside, sharing living space with humans, caused a nest of problems on the Colorado Plateau. She wondered if avoiding hantavirus, in addition to avoiding contact with the dead, was one of the reasons her people wisely stayed away from the abandoned ruins of the Pueblo ancestors that dotted the reservation. Fear of lingering spirits might be linked to the fact that mice urine and feces carry the deadly virus after the mice and the people had departed. When she opened the door to the unit, the radio squawked. It was Officer Manzanares. Bernie said, "Did they find Cruz?"
"Not yet. I'm not calling about that. A Cibola County deputy told me one of the kids in that group got violently ill. A fever, rapid heart, hallucinations. The hospital in Grants was full, so she's on her way to Gallup. The sheriff's department notified her parents. But here's the deal. She told the officer on the scene and the ambulance guy that she needed to talk to you because she lied about something."
"Annie Rainsong, right?"
"You got it. The attendant asked me to give you the message. He knew I'd been with a Navajo officer at the search site, so he called to see if I knew how to reach you."
Odd, Bernie thought. Did the girl mention if what she wasn't truthful about had something to do with Cruz?
"How would I know? I wasn't there, remember?"
"Are you sure she'll be at the hospital in Gallup, not Grants?"
"Gallup. She's going to Indian Medical Center. That's a good place for a drug overdose."
Bernie gave the Cibola ambulance crew a gold star in her imaginary tally of good public servants, even though Manzanares had delivered the message with attitude. Ambulance medics had plenty to do without conveying a request from a teenager. When she called the hospital,
After getting passed around to several desks, she connected with someone who told her Annie was in the emergency room. Then, as promised, she called her baby sister, putting her phone on speaker as she drove to the hospital. When Darlene didn't answer, Bernie left a brief message. "I talked to Mama. She's all right, but wanted me to ask you something. Call me." At the Gallup Hospital, Bernie went directly to the emergency room. The man at the registration desk responded.